the forces shaping your life right now are, well, they're pulling in two very different directions.
They really are.
On one side, you have all the political noise, right? The high stakes legal drama, chaos in federal courts, all this political
The
maneuvering.
stuff that gets the headline.
Exactly. But then on the other side, there's this quiet, almost mathematical force that's shaping your daily finances. And according to the research we've pulled, it's a system that seems specifically designed to inflate away the future of anyone who doesn't already own assets.
That contrast is really the core of our deep dive today. We've got sources that expose these deep structural flaws in both systems.
Both the legal and the financial.
Right. On the legal front, we're looking at a series of federal court rulings that show the executive branch trying to systematically bypass constitutional rules. And then we pivot to a major financial brief that just completely dissects this K-shaped economy.
So our mission is pretty straightforward.
It is. We want to give you the shortcut to understanding the foundational problems. When is the government overreaching its legal authority? And crucially, when is the economic system undercutting you, the average person, right in your own checking account?
We're going to start with this explosive saga of failed indictments and unlawful appointments. Then we'll connect that government chaos to the stark conclusion that, when inflation is accelerating, the only defense you really have is owning assets.
Yeah.
So let's unpack this institutional stress test. Okay, let's begin with a ruling that exposed a frankly startling pattern of overreach. A U.S. District Judge, Cameron Curry, recently ruled that Lindsey Halligan was unlawfully appointed as the interim U.S. Attorney for the Eastern District of Virginia.
And this wasn't just a one-off technicality. That's
Yeah.
the key thing our sources outline. It was part of a larger systemic problem.
Right. It wasn't an isolated mistake.
No. Similar rulings on unlawful appointments were made for Alina Haba in New Jersey and Bill Asaley in California, which, it makes you ask the question, why risk such a basic, easily preventable legal error?
It really feels like urgency and arrogance mixed together.
I think so.
I mean, the rule for interim appointments is clear: 120 days, that's it. The previous interim U.S. attorney, Eric Siebert, he hit that limit.
Right. And when he was reportedly pushed out, and this is because he was, let's say, reluctant to pursue criminal charges against people like Letitia James and James Comey, they just rushed to name Halligan to replace him.
And that move, that's what broke the law.
That's it. It violated the law against successive interim appointments. Once that 120-day clock has run, the power to appoint, it goes back to the district court, not the administration.
So Halligan was serving, but without any constitutional appointment.
Exactly. And the immediate consequence of that was, well, pretty predictable. The indictments she handled were invalidated.
Because she was the only one in her office to prepare the case, sign it, and present it to the grand jury. So Judge Curry found the indictments against Comey and James were improper. They were dismissed.
Yes.
But what really stands out to me is what the government tried to do after they got caught. Attorney General Pam Bondi tried to retroactively ratify Halligan's actions, just fix it after the fact.
And Judge Kerr's response to that attempt is the real nugget of insight here. She flatly rejected it.
Her quote was amazing.
It was. She basically said that allowing that would mean the government could send, and I'm quoting, any private citizen, off the street attorney or not, into the grand jury room, as long as the attorney general just gives a thumbs up after the fact.
Wow.
Yeah. The source analysis really sees this as a powerful message. The judiciary telling the executive branch, you can't just rewrite history to clean up your own overreach.
So the immediate outcome, case is dismissed, but without prejudice, meaning the DOJ could try again.
They could, but here's the catch. For James Comey, the statute of limitations ran out on September 30th. Ah, so that window was closed.
It's closed for good. And maybe more importantly, the court issued a direct political challenge. It said only the district court now has the authority to appoint the next interim U.S. attorney. So, if the court turns around and asks the previously reluctant Eric Siebert to come back.
That is a direct, very public statement of non-confidence in how the administration tried to handle this whole thing, a real political jab.
It's maybe not a surprise then that almost immediately after these dismissals, which had to have been embarrassing for the DOJ, we saw a pivot to a new target.
The timing is suspicious.
The Department of War initiated a review into alleged misconduct by Senator Mark Kelly. He's USN retired. And this review could lead to him being recalled for court-martial. It just looks like an attempt to weaponize military law for political reasons.
The timing is certainly something. But what's crucial for you to understand is just how many legal hurdles the administration faces here. According to our analysis, this case just looks remarkably weak.
Okay, well, let's run through them. The four big ones. First up, his status as a retired officer.
Correct. As a retiree, he is generally not subject to the Uniform Code of Military Justice, or the UCMJ. That's the law governing military conduct.
So he's a civilian, basically.
Mostly, yes. There are very narrow exceptions, but none of them seem to apply here. Second, he's a sitting senator.
Right. And if that video was recorded in his Senate office, which seems likely?
Then he's probably covered by the speech or debate clause, which is a huge constitutional protection. It gives him much greater freedom to speak politically than you or I have.
Okay, so what about his actual message? The most provocative thing he said was a statement of fact. Our laws are clear. You can refuse illegal orders.
And that phrase is the key. For speech to be punishable legally, it has to meet what's called the Brandenburg test. It has to be directed at inciting imminent lawless action and be likely to actually produce it.
Just stating a long-standing legal right doesn't seem to meet that bar.
Not even close. And any talk of sedition is just. It's completely unfounded. He didn't call for overthrowing the government. This whole review feels punitive, not legal.
And considering who Mark Kelly is, I mean, a war hero, combat pilot, and astronaut, this is a very high-profile fight to pick.
It is, but the real significance of his video and all this institutional chaos, it connects back to claims that the government is operating outside the law right now, internationally.
So Kelly's video wasn't just random.
Not at all. Colonel Paul Meagher, he's the senior judge advocate general for U.S. Southern Command, he has issued an opinion that current administration strikes in the Caribbean are, to put it bluntly, illegal.
And our allies seem to agree, or at least they're worried.
They are. The British government is actively withholding intelligence from the U.S. in the Caribbean.
Why?
To explicitly avoid being complicit in what they fear are illegal attacks on civilians. But the most revealing detail, the thing that shows the administration's own legal awareness, involves the survivors of one attack that killed over 80 people.
Instead of holding them, questioning them, they rushed them out of the country.
They sent the two survivors back to Colombia and Ecuador as fast as they could.
And the reason for that is to avoid a court case.
Exactly. If they were detained in the U.S., it would trigger court cases. Cases that would force the administration to answer very hard questions about the legal authority under which these operations are even running. So Kelly's point about refusing illegal orders, it's not some abstract idea. It's a live challenge to the legal foundation of current military actions.
So if these institutions, both legal and military, are struggling with their own integrity, the focus naturally shifts to politics.
Yeah.
How are politicians positioning themselves to deal with all this public distrust?
Precisely. We're shifting from institutional crisis to electoral response. Our sources analyze a recent op-ed from Kentucky Governor Andy Beshear. He wrote it as he's about to lead the Democratic Governors Association.
And the analysis sees it as a clear signal for a 2028 presidential run.
A signal and maybe a blueprint. He's trying to chart a course that, you know, avoids the perception of all this institutional failure.
And his strategy seems to have three core parts that directly hit on the economic anxiety we've been talking about.
First, he's all about showing tangible economic results. He points to winning Deep Red Henderson County by double digits after a paper mill opened with 320 high-paying jobs.
So real kitchen table economics.
Concrete results. Second, he emphasizes straight talk. He says, you know, let's ditch the jargon that alienates voters. He says people are hungry, not food insecure.
They have an addiction, not a substance use disorder.
Right. It cuts through that bureaucratic language that can sometimes feel like it's hiding the real problem.
And his third point is about connecting decisions to a moral framework, explaining the why.
Yes. He used his Christian faith to explain why he vetoed an anti-LGBTQ bill. His reasoning was that he believes all children are children of God, and that framing allowed him to withstand millions in attack ads.
So that whole approach, results, clear language, moral justification, that's what the analysis sees as a potent strategy for Democrats right now.
Exactly. Now, shifting to a more current battle that really illustrates the math involved, we have former Senator Doug Jones. He's jumping into the Alabama governor's race against Senator Tommy Tuberville.
And the math here is just, it's brutal for Jones. He's projected to do 19 points better than the last Democrat.
Which sounds great, right? Huge momentum.
But the last Democrat lost by 38 points.
Do the simple math. He's still 19 points in the hole. It just shows the massive challenge for Democrats in certain parts of the country where the national platform just doesn't connect.
So what's his strategy to try and close a gap that big.
He's going hard on painting Tuberville as a carpetbagger, someone who really lives in Florida, not Alabama. That's an angle that can work in state politics.
Right.
But the analysis notes that while opponents often point out Tuberville's perceived lack of, you know, intelligence, that's offset by his experience as a successful football coach in Alabama.
Which, in that state, is a very relevant resume.
It's a huge source of political currency.
Yeah.
That history and familiarity with the local culture can outweigh typical political qualifications. It becomes a battle of identity versus policy.
Identity and politics, they create a lot of noise. But what the sources make clear is that those fights often distract from this silent, systematic erosion of wealth that's happening in the background.
And that's where our sources connect the institutional chaos to the structural reality of the K-shaped economy.
What's the core thesis of the financial brief?
It's stark. The establishment's preferred policy is to constantly expand the money supply. More debt, more liquidity. And this achieves one primary goal. It inflates the value of financial and real assets.
Making the wealthy much richer.
Much richer, while at the same time silently destroying the purchasing power of the wages earned by everyone else.
And we have evidence this money expansion isn't slowing down, it's actually picking up.
Yes. If you look at the M2 money supply, that's the broad measure of money circulating, including bank deposits, the data shows M2 is reaccelerating at the fastest pace since July 2022.
So just more dollars being created.
More dollars being created, which means every dollar you already have, it shrinks in value.
And this expansion leads directly to what's called the K-shaped economy. Can you explain what that means for an average household?
Sure. Think of the letter K. It has two lines splitting apart. Those are two parallel realities. The upper slope owns asset stocks, real estate. For them, inflation is a massive tailwind. Their wealth compounds faster than prices rise.
And the lower slope.
The lower slope relies on a paycheck. They get squeezed by rising costs for everything, housing, food, gas, while their wages lag behind. Inflation is a constant drag, always pushing them backward.
And we can see the personal impact of that squeeze in, a pretty stunning statistic from the materials.
It's incredible. Half of American parents now provide regular financial support to their adult children.
Not for luxuries.
Yeah.
For basics like groceries and rent.
Half of American families. If you're listening, you are likely either giving or receiving that support. And that statistic is a flashing red light. It tells us that for half the country, the system no longer works well enough for one generation to even stand on its own two feet.
Meanwhile, the Federal Reserve will claim inflation is down because they cite monthly declines. But that's an optics game, isn't it?
It is, because inflation compounds. It's cumulative. If your cost of living went up 10% one year and 3% the next, you're still 13% poorer than you were 2 years ago relative to what you earn.
And since wages aren't keeping up, people get stuck.
Stuck in a paycheck-to-paycheck trap with no capital left over to invest in the very assets they need to escape.
So what's the conclusion from the source material? What's the only practical way forward in this kind of environment?
The conclusion is unambiguous. The system is structured to necessitate asset ownership. To fight inflation, you really have two paths. A, your wage grows faster than inflation, which for most people, history shows is just not going to happen consistently.
Or B,
you own assets, any assets that inflate faster than inflation. Investing is no longer a luxury to get rich. It's become the required defense mechanism just to stay afloat against the quiet erosion of the monetary system.
It seems like the complexity of the monetary system is the ultimate guarantor of this K-shaped disparity. We've covered a rapid journey today. We started with the technical failures of unlawful legal appointments, these things that invalidated major political indictments.
Mm-hmm.
We moved to the unprecedented political challenge against Senator Mark Kelly, and we finished with the cold, hard reality of the K-shaped economy, which is impacting your family's budget right now.
And the common structural thread is clear. The institutions that are supposed to protect the public, the legal system, the military chain of command, the central bank, they're all showing signs of severe stress or, in some cases, actively enabling disparity.
The legal framework failed in those appointments.
Right. The military structure is being tested on the limits of illegal orders, and the financial structure is systematically inflating away the future of anyone who doesn't own assets.
So if the political fights are often just noise and the economic game is rigged to require asset ownership just to stay economically relevant, that leaves us with an important final question for you to consider. If half of American families are relying on parental support just to cover the basics, How long until that widespread economic precarity on the downward slope of the K translates into a powerful, unified political action? An action that demands deep structural change. Keep an eye on how that mounting economic pressure shapes the political landscape in the months ahead.